Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3. I'm Katie Derham and you're listening to a prom performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and conducted by a man who has had a meteoric rise. Andras Nelson's still only 31.
The process of rehearsing is the most important. I find it even more important than the concert itself, because that's where you create the chemistry with your musicians and actually where you open your fantasy to music. And when the architecture, the building is built in the rehearsal, you have to encourage them to open the fantasy and to create the atmosphere. So I think for me it's important to create the images and pictures. So the two languages we speak is a technical language, of course, which is a professional language of marcato, staccato, risoluto, or any of these. But it is just a technical language, which is not the final result. It is like wine without alcohol. Then we put the alcohol, which is an image, is a fantasy, to create the atmosphere, what is behind the notes. And that is a real importance. And I try to combine these two things together. You know, if you come as a conductor and you say, well, let's play this like this and that like that, and there is no contact, no emotional contact, it doesn't work. I think it is just pure professional work, and I think that is a crime for music. I think we need to do our work and to enjoy music with all our heart and try to look into the eyes of the musicians and try to inspire. And then they give so much back, you know, and I learn from them.
Andras Nelson saying that conducting without passion is like wine without the alcohol. Just one of the colourful images that his musicians love hearing from him. He's a conductor whose manner has been described by many of them today, to me actually, as hugely endearing. No question they love playing for him. And the chemistry with him was immediate. He was offered the job with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra within days of their first concert together. And that never happens so quickly. And one of the pieces they played that fateful day, well, it was the one we are about to hear now, Dvorak's New World Symphony, if you like, his audition piece. It was famously written when Dvorak was living in America. In fact, he'd only been there a few months when he started writing this, which is, I think, his most famous work. He was apparently fascinated and faintly appalled by New York, by the pace, by the variety. It is, though, a fabulously easy work to enjoy. It was a smash from the first performance, and of course it has that theme. And earlier, I spoke to core Anglo player Alan Garner about the pressure and the pleasure of performing it.
Let's face it, it's one of the best known and best loved tunes in all of music, even to people who actually don't particularly like classical music or orchestral music. They know it maybe because they watch the TV and picture it with brown bread. The other difficulty, if you like, is the fact that that is all I do in the whole concert. So there's a long wait and a lot of time for your nerves to get going and the heart to race. But of course, when you come in, you've got to sound serene, calm, and beautiful.
So how do you do that?
I guess it all comes down to experience, really. You've just got to, that's where all your training comes into effect. But basically, just enjoy it, that's the thing. It's a pleasure and a privilege to get the chance to play a tune like that.
There's some discussion, isn't there, about whether or not your theme particularly is based on a Negro spiritual, or if in fact it's more of a sort of a home-based theme, if you like, a Bohemian Czech theme. What do you think?
Well, the answer is I really don't know. But it always seems to me when I listen to the piece and play the piece that actually it makes me think of somebody who is away from their homeland. And it may be that the origins of it perhaps did come from a Negro spiritual or some sort of other indigenous American music. But to me, he's very much harking back to the land that he's left behind. And I think that's one of the reasons why it actually resonates so much, because it is such a poignant tune. And if you want poignancy, then head for the cor anglais. It's the instrument of choice for that, for many, many composers. And somehow it is beautiful, but it's so sad. You pine for something that you've lost, it seems to me, anyway.
Cor anglais player Alan Garner telling me about the pressures and the privilege, as he put it, of playing the famous theme of Dvorak's New World Symphony. Well, the orchestra is tuned up, the hall is full and ready for the performance, and the conductor, Andras Nelson, is coming onto the stage now to conduct the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in Dvorak's New World Symphony.
Thank you.
Andreas Nelson's conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in a fabulously energetic and expressive New World Symphony written by a homesick Dvorak. Influences there, of course, from his new home in America, from the Wild West, Shades of Hiawatha, Negro spirituals. But as Alan Garner, the core Anglo player, described it earlier, plaintive and pining in many parts. And didn't he play fabulously as well? No sign of any nerves there or any tension. He even got a silent bravo from the maestro. And in fact, Alan's now being brought to his feet. And listen to the reaction from the crowd. Other members of the wind section being singled out for praise as well. There was some wonderful solo work. So many members of the orchestra today have described Andreas Nelson as endearing, and in that performance, you really could see and hear why. He just completely inhabits the music. I actually thought he was about to break down in tears halfway through the second movement. He's still bringing various section leaders to their feet. To the the great enjoyment of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall, and now the whole orchestra, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. They who chose Anders Nelsons as quickly as he chose them when they first played him playing that particular piece. Anders Nelsons taught by his great friend and mentor, Marius Janssens. The story goes that he did a deal. He stepped into the breach as a professional trumpet player when Marius Janssens was conducting a performance of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. And instead of taking any pay, he said, rather than money, could I spend a week just observing you, maestro? And that's how the friendship began, and that's how his life as a conductor began as well. He's back on the stage. He wants the orchestra to take a bow, but they won't because they are applauding him. They do love him. They won't stand up. He keeps on gesturing to them with his big, long, lanky limbs. Please stand up. But they won't. They're too busy cheering him. They've got to their feet. I suspect there's a bit of history there. Bit of a standing joke. Well, if that's not enough promming for you for one night, don't go away. There is a late night prom starting here at 10 o'clock here on Radio 3. More Dvorak. Some Mozart too with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, and it would have been conducted by the late Sir Charles Mackerras. Douglas Boyd has stepped in to his shoes. Tomorrow, Sir Mark Elder will be here conducting the Australian Youth Orchestra in Mahler, Shostakovich, and the London premiere of a work called Amphitheatre by an Australian composer called Brett Dean. He's to be principal viola at the Berlin Phil, I believe. And don't forget, looking ahead to Saturday, it is the celebration of Stephen Sondheim's 80th birthday. Live here on Radio 3, a little later on at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. I'll be presenting that one. I cannot wait. Promises to be a fabulous night. I've been watching their rehearsals all week, and really exciting that's been too. But as the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra finally leave the stage with their conductor and musical director, Anders Nelsons, thank you for being here with me tonight. It's time, though, for me to now hand you back to my colleague in Broadcasting House, Jonathan Swain.
Katie, thank you. Katie Derham there. And as well as the BBC iPlayer, she mentioned, for listening again, just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on the good old Steam Radio. That's on Tuesday afternoon, this coming Tuesday afternoon, at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, in around 8 minutes' time this evening, Ideas, the British version. More on that in a couple of minutes. Until then, back to Dvorak. Dvorak for voice and piano. This is a group of his gypsy songs, and the soprano is Gabriela Beniachkova, and the pianist a one-time pupil of Janáček, Rudolf Firkušný. The strings are tuned before it when my mother taught me to sing and at the start, and the woods are silent. Three of the gypsy songs, Opus 55, by Dvorak, the soprano there, Gabriela Benyachkova, and the pianist, Rudolf Firkushny.
A celebration of the genius of Stephen Sondheim. An amazing cast perform songs from some of his best-loved shows with the BBC Concert Orchestra and conductor David Charles Abell.
Well, Stephen Sondheim creates a unique sound world for each of his musicals. I mean, for Little Night Music, it's the world of the Viennese Waltz. For Sweeney Todd, it's sort of shock horror movie music. And for Company, it's 70s contemporary sound. It's going to be a joy to create all those worlds with the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is the ideal instrument to do all those different styles.
Sondheim at 80 in the BBC Proms, Saturday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, we're back at the Proms in 45 minutes' time. Dvorak's Wind Serenade and the Mozart Grand Partita Serenade, the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Douglas Boyd. That's at 10 o'clock. It's now 9:15, and now on BBC Radio 3, another chance to hear Ideas, the British version, the series in which historian and now Labour MP Tristram Hunt traces the path of ideas that have emerged in this country and then spread beyond our shores. In this programme, first broadcast last October, as the new Supreme Court opened in London, Tristram examines the separation of powers, a concept at the heart of a good many national constitutions, and he finds that it has its origins in 18th century Britain and in the work of a French philosopher who made sense of what he saw here.
Across Parliament Square from the Palace of Westminster, a new addition to our constitution opened for business this week, the UK Supreme Court. In a clear separation of powers, the law lords have now left the House of Lords for their own smart, refurbished building. To critics, this marks an unnecessary, utilitarian reform to our constitution, opening up the prospect of a new US-style Supreme Court. To others, it stands as an essential modernisation of British legal practice.
One senior judge told me he was converted to this idea when he left the House of Lords and sought a taxi, and the taxi driver said, "Are you a member of the House of Lords, chum?" And he said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Made any good laws today, have you?" And he thought that wasn't the sort of question that ought to be directed at a judge.
"I, Nicholas Ellison, Baron Phillips of Worth Matravers, do swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful..."
The law lords have been doing the job of Supreme Court for centuries. There were those who argued that, therefore, there was no need to change. My view is that there was. So the time was right for this.
"In the office of President of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, and I will do right to all manner of people after the laws and usages of this realm..."
But the separation of the judiciary from the legislature, the judges from Parliament, is not a foreign idea. In fact, it marks the fulfilment of a philosophy which began here in Britain and went on to provide the template for nation builders around the world. It was in London in the 1730s that the French philosopher Montesquieu first discovered the separation of powers, that demarcation between the executive, the government or monarch, the legislature, members of parliament, and the judicial system. And I want to follow the remarkable journey this idea has made before coming to rest back in Britain. For Montesquieu, born in 1689, the attraction of England was partly the product of the political failings of France. He grew up in a society still overshadowed by the fearful royal absolutism of the Sun King, Louis XIV. As Silvana Tomaselli, a Montesquieu scholar at St John's College, Cambridge, explains.
"In order to understand the 18th century and the first three decades of life in 18th century France, one has to look back to the 17th century, to the long reign of Louis XIV, a reign in which he waged a number of wars, very expensive wars, which would lead France to a very difficult position in the 18th century, a very difficult financial position, which will have to be addressed by effectively everyone with a modicum of power. What it meant was that the will of the king, of Louis XIV, was final. There was no court of appeal beyond that, and what the king decided was law. When he dies in 1715, there begins a period, the regency. During that period, the nobility is trying to recoup some of the power it has lost. So the discussions that will be held in the salon will be discussion as to the nature of France's monarchy, what it ought to be, what it has become. And the question is what role the privileged orders, what role the Parlement, what role the Catholic Church has to play within this monarchy. This tension is, it's the story of 18th century France, really.
In the exclusive Saint-Germain-des-Prés district of Paris sits Le Procope restaurant, founded in 1686. This is now a history-themed, glamorous restaurant with quotations from Rousseau on the walls and portraits of Diderot and Voltaire lining the walls. But in the 18th century, this was a far more rambunctious, noisy, dangerous place. It was a coffee house where some of the greatest minds of the period would come to discuss new publications, new ideas, often radical thoughts. Voltaire would have been here, Diderot would have been here, and of course, Montesquieu himself. Well, joining me here now amongst the well-laid tables are Céline Spector from the Department of Philosophy, University of Bordeaux Trois, and Anne Thompson from Paris 8, an Enlightenment scholar, and author most recently of Bodies of Thought. And what was the intellectual atmosphere like in the 18th century in what was then a coffee house here where we're seated?
Well, in the early part of the 18th century, which was when Montesquieu frequented literary circles and polite circles in Paris, this was a place during the Régence where people came to discuss not only political ideas, but somewhat heterodox religious ideas as well. And there are various descriptions of people discussing in coded language the existence of God while police spies listened in on them. It was a place where people exchanged not only big ideas, also gossip as well. There was a lot of gossip that went on.
Céline, do we know if Montesquieu came here? We know he was certainly part of this world, don't we, whilst he was in Paris in the 1720s.
Montesquieu was certainly part of the best society, and he was acquainted with a lot of philosophers and men and women of letters. And in the Persian Letter, one of these famous earlier publications, 1721, Montesquieu mentions one of the Parisian cafes, probably the Procope.
Coffee is very much used in Paris. There are a great many public houses where it may be had. There is one where the coffee is prepared in such a way that it makes those who drink it witty. At least there is not a single soul who, on quitting this house, does not believe himself four times wittier than when he entered it. But that which shocks me most in these geniuses is that they are quite useless to their country and amuse their talents with puerilities.
Now, Céline, Montesquieu is Baron de Montesquieu. He's not Parisian by birth and upbringing. He's from Bordeaux. Can you give us some sense of Montesquieu's background?
Well, Montesquieu was raised near Bordeaux and he lived in a very famous castle, La Brède. Montesquieu also married a Protestant woman and he became rich because of her. He was président à Mortier of the Parlement of Bordeaux, which was one of the provincial parliaments in France. He inherited this legal office, and so he had quite important legal duties there. And he was actually not very interested in his job, and he sold his charge in 1726.
What does that mean? That means he no longer has to carry out his function.
Exactly, because the function was quite heavy indeed, and he didn't want to be, let's say, linked with it. So then he started his successful entry in the Parisian world and even at court.
One of his early interests and one of his abiding interests is in the history and nature and understanding of liberty. Why is Montesquieu drawn to this subject?
At this time, the main topic was, I would say, absolute power and the way to limit and to find boundaries for this absolute power. And of course, liberty is the other side of it, because if you have absolute power, you have no liberty, and that's Montesquieu's figure of despotism.
The power was quite firmly in the hands of the monarch, whereas, of course, in Britain after 1689, we have this not quite balance, but limitation to some extent of the power of the monarchy by the parliament, which, of course, didn't exist in France at the time.
The work which brings Montesquieu early fame and interest and propels him into Parisian society is the Persian Letters. Céline, tell us about the Persian Letters. What was Montesquieu's purpose in this work?
Well, the Persian Letters is a satirical work. The story is very simple. There are two Persian noblemen, and they are coming westward to visit Europe and mostly France, and they write letters and relate what they see. The idea is to present French politics, religion, and mores from an outsider's eyes.
In terms of Montesquieu's political thinking, what emerges from the Persian Letters?
Actually, there are a lot of ideas on despotism, monarchy, and republic. He already has a theory of forms of government. What is important for Montesquieu is that what he sees in England is the absolute power of the king that is always contested. That there is a country in Europe where the power of the king is not holy or sacred anymore. Montesquieu says about England through Uzbek's voice, a Persian character, that, quote, all the nations of Europe are not equally submissive.
All the nations of Europe are not equally submissive to their princes. The impatient humour of the English, for instance, leaves their king hardly any time to make his authority felt. Submission and obedience are virtues upon which they flatter themselves but little. If a prince, instead of making the lives of his subjects happy, attempts to oppress and ruin them, the basis of obedience is destroyed. Nothing binds them, nothing attaches them to him, and they return to their natural liberty. The English maintain that all unlimited power must be unlawful, because it cannot have had a lawful origin.
Now Montesquieu wanted to see for himself. Having read so much and even written about foreign constitutions, in 1728 he set off with his friend Lord Waldegrave on a grand tour, as every young European aristocrat was wont to do. He visited the Italian city-states, the German principalities and the Dutch republics, and eventually he did as I'm doing, cross the Channel, not under it via Eurostar, but in the luxury of an ambassador's boat from Holland. After years of hearing tales about the English system of governance, Montesquieu was about to see it in action. And he was even more impressed than he had first imagined.
England is at present the country in the world where there is the greatest freedom. I do not make an exception for any republic.
We're now on the eighth floor of the Victoria Tower in the Palace of Westminster. Looking north out of the window, we see the House of Lords and then the House of Commons, and then even further up Whitehall is Downing Street, the centres of modern British power. Joining me here in the parliamentary archives are Justin Champion from Royal Holloway, University of London, and Rachel Hammersley from the University of Newcastle. Montesquieu came, if not to this building, which would burn down 100 years later, but to the Palace of Westminster when he came to Britain in 1729. Justin, what kind of society, what kind of vista does he see when he gets to London?
Montesquieu's an aristocrat. I think we should always remember that. He may write about liberty, but he's not really very interested in dealings with the lower orders. And some of his first impressions of London are really quite appalled. You know, it's narrow. He says, you know, Paris is a beautiful city with some ugly bits in it. London is a very ugly city with only a small amount of beautiful things. So he's moving in very elite aristocratic circles. So he has a perspective on England that's quite rarefied, I think.
And his purpose here is to unpick this idea of liberty, to try and get to the roots of it. Is that his primary motivation in England?
I think he's very concerned to think about what liberty is as distinct from freedom. He's a comparative political scientist in some sense, and he's always trying to connect the sort of nature of the place, the manners, the customs, the sort of material life with the political values and processes.
And for Montesquieu in particular, because he developed his kind of typography of governments, and the thing about England is it doesn't fit that typography. So he has monarchies, republics and despotisms, and he can fit other systems into those categories. England doesn't fit. He says at one point it's a republic hidden under the form of a monarchy. So he's aware that it's unusual and that the fact that it has political liberty as its object is part of that distinctiveness, and he wants to explore that and understand it.
Do we have any reflections or commentaries on people who met Montesquieu here? Do we have any knowledge of how he was received in English society?
The only thing I know is he's invited by John, Duke of Montagu, to Blenheim Palace for a great diplomatic reception. John, Duke of Montagu, is presumably quite a thick aristocrat, because he thinks the funniest thing he could do, welcoming a great distinguished baron de Montesquieu into his palace, is to actually lay a booby trap for him with a bath of water under a carpet. And poor old Montesquieu wanders in, gets drenched, and is recorded as saying, well, I suppose that's what they do here, I'm not sure.
I think the other thing to say about the circles in which he mixed were that not all of them, but a large number of them were anti-Walpole. So they were opposed to the new Whigs at the time.
So give us some sense of this political context when you say anti-Walpole. What is the political scene which Montesquieu confronts when he's here?
Walpole is leading the government at the time and is trying to kind of, in a sense, strengthen the role of the ministers as against Parliament. And there's a lot of concern about that. And you have a kind of alliance of old Whigs and Tories who are opposed to this, sometimes thought of in terms of the country opposition, if you like, as opposed to the kind of central government rulers. And so it's these kinds of people who are concerned about the increasing encroachment of the ministers on Parliament and on the political system.
Walpole is a Whig who's committed to principles of liberty, committed to principles of toleration. And he has a weak monarch, in the instance of George I and then George II. So he's very capable at organising the mechanisms of national politics. Now, I think we often forget that from Voltaire's perspective or Montesquieu's perspective, even this corrupted system is a land of liberty.
I think it's also the fact that you've got, that it's precisely what you say, that Walpole sees himself as being involved with liberty, that's some of the debates that are taking place at the time about precisely what is liberty then, because in a sense both sides are wanting to claim it. And so there is this debate that's going on in some of the journals of the time in terms of, well, what is liberty and how is it protected? And I think that's one of the things that Montesquieu is very interested in when he comes.
Those debates were taking place not just in journals, they were taking place where we are now in the Palace of Westminster, in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And we've got a transcript in front of us. One of the most contentious debates of the time was whether England should have a standing army. And this comes up in a debate in the House of Commons in 1730, debate on the land forces, where Mr. Shippen, a member of Parliament, speaks up and says, Force and violence are the resort of usurpers
and tyrants only. I perceive some gentlemen may take offence at my words, and therefore, that they may not be misconstrued, I will repeat them. I assert, then, it is a grounded maxim in civil science that force and violence are the resort of usurpers and tyrants only, because they are, with good reason, distrustful of the people whom they oppress, and because they have no other security for the continuance of their unlawful and unnatural dominion than what depends entirely on the strength of their armies. But it is a peculiar happiness and glory of Great Britain to be blessed with a prince who wants no such support, who reigns absolute in the hearts of his subjects, who prefers their ease and interest to the luster and grandeur of his crown.
This is a debate about power, about the control of power in modern systems of government, whether you are based on force power of an army or whether, as Mr. Shippen says, the ease and interests of the people.
Yeah, and the sense, certainly among some of the figures that Montesquieu is associated with, the idea that, that power does corrupt and that therefore you have to recognise that and you have to put in place means of preventing the rulers from just doing what they want in their own interests. And the trouble with the standing army is that it gives a ruler the power that they can then use against the population.
And Montesquieu is listening to these debates. He's coming to Parliament. He's taking this in.
Absolutely. And I think he's also very aware of the great political debates in the newspapers and journals outside of the House of Parliament. And the Craftsman in particular is particularly virulent.
What was The Craftsman?
The Craftsman is the weekly journal, I think, produced really by Bolingbroke. And it's the powerful voice of this criticism of the Walpolean regime.
And we know for certain that Montesquieu picked up both on the parliamentary debate and on the extracts from the Craftsman because he records them in the journals and notes that he keeps while he's in England.
In a constitution like ours, the safety of the whole depends on the balance of the parts, and the balance of the parts on their mutual independency on one another. If the legislative, as well as the executive power, was wholly in the king, as in some countries, he would be absolute. If in the Lords, our government would be an aristocracy. If in the Commons, a democracy. It is this division of power, these distinct privileges attributed to the King, to the Lords and to the Commons, which constitute a limited monarchy. Since this division of power and these distinct privileges constitute and maintain our government, it follows that the confusion of them tends to destroy it. The Craftsman.
This balance is absolutely crucial, that you have these different elements within government and they each have a particular function, a particular role, and that if one encroaches on it, you know, it is a kind of balancing act and you've got to keep them in an equilibrium. And that if one element encroaches on another, that can upset the balance and then you're going to end up losing liberty. This is, again, it's all about the protection of liberty.
Till jarring interests of themselves create the according music of the well-mixed state.
We're now in St. Stephen's in the heart of the Palace of Westminster, where Montesquieu would have come in 1730 to hear the debates, to get a feel of the political culture in England. To my right is where Walpole would have sat occupying the government benches, and where I'm stood now is where the Speaker's chair would have been, and on the left those opposed, not yet an official opposition, but those opposed to the Walpole ministry.
I assert then it is a grounded maxim in civil science that force and violence are the resort of usurpers and tyrants only.
Today we now have a regular cycle of touring parties coming through the Palace of Westminster, where Montesquieu, as another tourist in the 18th century, would have passed along. Joining me is David Pryor, assistant clerk to the records at the Palace of Westminster. David, what kind of world would Montesquieu have seen here in Westminster in the 18th century?
I guess sometimes we refer to it as a Westminster village. I mean, it was a kind of clutter of medieval buildings beside the Thames. Westminster Hall, which is right next to where we're standing now, you had things like pamphlet sellers, and it was a kind of a hubbub of politics. I guess Montesquieu would have witnessed that when he actually arrived at the palace.
What you get here is a clear sense of the pride and power of the legislative body within the British Constitution. The iconography celebrates quite powerfully the role of the legislative within British history. On my left is a statue of the parliamentarian Clarendon. On my right, a statue of the great Civil War hero Hampden. This was the place where the legislative faced down the executive, where Parliament faced down the king. And that sense of the balance of power was enormously important to the unwritten British Constitution in the 18th century. Another institution Montesquieu was closely involved with during his time in England was the Royal Society, the premier scientific body of its day. We've now walked across from Westminster Hall over St. James's Park to the Royal Society's modern headquarters at Carlton House Terrace. Justin, what was Montesquieu's interest in science? Why was he involved with the Royal Society?
Montesquieu was a member of all sorts of academies for the exploration of sort of philosophical, scientific matters in France. And his essential interest in the material, the natural world, was what drove him both to become a member of the Royal Society, but also his broad project on linking environment and politics. He says everything that exists has a law. If you study and observe it, you'll work out how it works.
So he goes back to France, having made his grand tour, having had his time here in England, in Parliament, at the Royal Society, with the aristocracy, and he retreats to write that massive, complicated, often rambling, but very brilliant book, The Spirit of the Laws. Rachel, what's it about?
I feared that was going to be the next question. It's a huge book in which he tries to pull out ideas about law and about the way in which it operates in different countries. Something that he's trying to get something that holds everything together, that kind of somehow makes sense of all the different variations, all the different systems in different places.
So Justin, where within that typology does the separation of powers come in?
Montesquieu is interested in liberty. Most of the Spirit of Laws is about that first institutional question. How do we get a constitution that preserves the utmost of liberty, which ultimately would be a citizen being only bound by law and not fearful of anybody persecuting them under law or over law. So Montesquieu's principle of the separation of powers comes from this huge trawl of all human history and all contemporary societies, that judiciary, executive and legislative must be separate in order that each power balances itself. And in the famous chapter on the British Constitution, he describes there the ideal example.
So that one cannot abuse power, power must check power by the arrangement of things. If the executive power does not have the right to check the enterprises of the legislative body, the latter will be despotic, for it will wipe out all the other powers, since it will be able to give to itself all the power it can imagine.
His account of the separation of powers appears in the chapter where he is describing England. He starts that chapter by setting up the separation of powers. This, for him, is what characterises the English system of government.
And I think in that chapter 6 of book 11, where he goes into really quite considerable detail, he's thought about it very carefully. You know, the king or the monarchy has the right of veto over certain things. The executive, you know, has control over certain legislative processes. The legislature can restrain the executive. So it's a very careful, not mechanistic, but almost organic balance.
And it's absolutely crucial that balance is kept and that none of those elements encroaches beyond the powers that they are entitled to have. And he actually talks about why that has to be the case. So, for example, in terms of taxation, it's very important that the executive is not allowed to control that. That must be controlled by the legislature, because if you allow the executive to control taxation, then they will, you know, accrue more power than is good for them.
And you'll be back to standing armies. That's how they'll pay for their armies.
Exactly.
So who is Montesquieu writing this book for?
It is a European publication. It's known in America, it's known in the globe. My sense is that Montesquieu is a classic Enlightenment figure. He is speaking the truth. He's doing the research, he's looking empirically at everything, and he is discovering, perhaps as Newton did, the laws of politics. And that's the beauty of his work. It's about diversity. Montesquieu wouldn't be saying import British democracy into Iraq. It wouldn't work. Different climates, different traditions. So he's writing a book for the world, I think.
One of the countries where Montesquieu's idea of the separation of powers really takes off is across the Atlantic in America. Why do you think Montesquieu is picked up there? Why is the separation of powers suddenly so exciting a concept there?
The American moment is the third great British Revolution. You know, very often we think of the colonies sort of, you know, unhinging their shackles, but very much the people who were involved in that process were Englishmen. They were British thinkers who'd absorbed these long radical Whig traditions. So Montesquieu in some sense embodies much of the thinking and writing that they were enormously familiar with. So the Franklins, the Adamses and all of those sorts of people live in a world that the classics of Tacitus and, you know, all of that radical republican tradition from antiquity, it's there in their minds. So Montesquieu's enormously valuable handbook. At the same time, they're reading Locke, they're reading Gibbon, they're reading the classics of resistance theory, and it's that world that is suddenly given opportunity in the 1770s to invent a new constitution.
So 1649, the English Civil War, 1688, the Glorious Revolution, 1776, the American Revolution. Actually, this is an Atlanticist discussion about the separation of powers, and you have Montesquieu halfway through almost providing a guide and running commentary.
On how to do it, yeah. It's a DIY book, even if quite a clunky one.
The British are coming!
Instructions of the inhabitants of the town of Boston to their representatives in Congress, 1776. It is essential to liberty that the legislative, judicial, and executive powers of government be, as nearly as possible, independent of and separate from each other. For where they are united in the same persons or number of persons, there would be wanting that mutual check which is the principal security against the making of arbitrary laws and a wanton exercise of power in the execution of them.